You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
I got a lot of problems.
The song was done, and the credits were done completely after the film was finished. It's really the first of the original music that I ever wrote for any of my movies. Charles Ruggiero, who was the editor at the time, knew someone who owned this song. I think it was called Black Velvet Soul. And he got what he called just the music without the words, and we made a deal together to do this song. I wrote the lyrics, and we all went to, I believe, L.A. and did it in a real studio, something that is amazing. No, I think Divine lived in L.A. then, maybe. So we did it in a whole recording studio, and I can remember rehearsing with Divine to do this song. And I still like the song. I think it's a good one. Of my early movies, I completely believe it's by far the best one. It's certainly the best vehicle for Divine. It was written to be a vehicle for Divine. And I've said before, but it's true, it shows off really Divine's glamorous, insane beauty and my mental illness in the best way, I think.
You've been described as an American icon, and in fact, James Egan described you as the father of modern cinema.
Well, he must have been on LSD or something. I think maybe an icon to some disturbed group of people in each city, which is very nice, you know. And wherever I go, there seems to be enough disturbed people to keep me in the icon business and make me let me continue to make my living doing what I do without getting a real job.
In terms of being the father of modern cinema, why would he describe?
I think
you
he must
way?
Have meant underground cinema. I can't be the father of cinema, please.
Tell me about who were your influences when you first started out, when you were first given a camera. What were the movies that you enjoyed seeing?
Well, certainly at the very beginning, Russ Meyer. At the very beginning when I was a kid, Walt Disney, because I love the villains, and I wanted to be the villains, and I always rooted for the villains. I wanted to be Captain Hook. I wanted to be the wicked stepmother in Cinderella. So I loved them. And then later, underground movies came out. So the Kuchar brothers were kind of like the Warner Brothers of the underground, and Warhol and Kenneth Anger. But then I also was seeing sexploitation movies like Kenneth Anger and gore movies with Herschel Gordon Lewis, and then foreign films, especially Ingmar Bergman, because he always had dramatic, he had nudity, he had vomit, he had subject matter that was unheard of in Hollywood movies. So I try to put all three of those things together.
Is that what was going on with Dreamlanders? Was that the theory behind that group?
There was no theory behind it, but when we were making those movies, I liked all that. Divine always used to say, "Oh, please don't make me see Ingmar Bergman," because we would be tripping, and I would take him to Hour of the Wolf. Let me see Elizabeth Taylor movies. Can't we see movies about rich people? Mary Vivian Pierce was in my movies I went to most of all the art movies with. But we saw everything. We would go see the trashy drive-in movies and then see the Bergman Festival. And not that many people were seeing both, and I was putting the extremes of both of them together to try and come up, I guess in hindsight, I wasn't thinking this then, of a genre of exploitation films for art theaters, because my movies never did great in real drive-ins. They did great in the richest, fanciest neighborhoods, unfortunately, I'm embarrassed to admit. The worst taste did the best in the best taste neighborhood.
Why? How do you explain that?
Because it was an attack on good taste with humor, but you have to know good taste to appreciate the irony of celebrating bad taste. And if you just have bad taste, you don't get it.
Hi there. Welcome to this episode of Just the Discs. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have what I like to call one of my core people on the show tonight, Miss Stephanie Crawford. Thank you for coming back again.
Thanks for having me back.
Always.
That's so cool, being part of the core.
Totally, yes. I really actually like the movie The Core, by the way. I hope that comes out on Blu-ray at some point. anyway, we won't even get on that sidetrack. But
yeah,
I
wasn't prepared to talk about The Core. I'm sorry.
It's totally fine. So I'm really excited to have Stephanie on the show tonight because we are going to talk about, among other things, John Waters. And Stephanie, I know to be a gigantic fan of John Waters. We're going to speak specifically about Female Trouble in the new Criterion Blu-ray.
The star of Pink Flamingos is here again. It's Divine. She's got balls, and she's got Female Trouble.
I'm a thief and a shit kicker, and I'd like to be famous.
Share the tears and laughter with Divine, Edith Massey as Aunt Ida, and the Pink Flamingos gang. A new high in low taste. John Waters' Female Trouble. She had a lot of problems. Coming soon from Saliva Films.
And then just sort of as an extra added bonus, we're going to throw in one of the craziest fucking movies in the world, and that is Extro. But that's for later. But for now, Stephanie, tell me why you love John Waters so much.
Wow. It's like a very simple and obvious and fair question. He's my favorite living filmmaker.
Nice.
And I discovered him as a child with Hairspray, which is, I think, a lot of kids' entry-level John Waters movies.
That's note to self. I'm going to show Raven that one. I haven't done that yet.
Yeah, I think for me it went Hairspray, Crybaby, Serial Mom, and He Had Me for Life.
Nice.
Serial Mom is my introduction to Herschel Gordon Lewis, so I owe him quite a bit.
I still think it's badass that he has Herschel Gordon Lewis in like a major studio film and a bunch of kids watching one of his movies and he's featured prominently. I just think that's awesome.
It is awesome. And that's part of why I love him so much. You know, he's talked about how trashy he is, and it's true, but everything has such a heart to it, as such a sense of fun. Like, none of his movies, even the grimy early ones, they don't come off as mean-spirited. It's just this gorgeous insanity. I just love everything about it. I love the sense of humor. I love the aesthetic. I love like his long takes of dialogue with characters you will not see in any other movie. He's a true original. But I never feel like he's just throwing in weird things to be weird.
No. I just realized how much I actually like his dialogue when I was watching Female Trouble again. And I also realized that I think Female Trouble is maybe my favorite John Waters movie, except for Serial Mom. It's like those two for me.
Same here.
Oh, really? Those are your top two? That's pretty cool. Yeah, those two movies are... I mean, and it's great because you've got sort of a representation of the early period and then the later period, but it's all him. And yeah, I forgot how much, I guess I'd always, sorry, I don't want to interrupt your talking about John Waters, but that's what we're going to just talk about him. I'd forgotten that, you know, I guess I'd rolled Female Trouble in with Pink Flamingos. And I, you know, I respect Pink Flamingos, if that doesn't sound too weird, because it's just so incredibly audacious. And just the idea that a movie got started because, or supposedly, I don't know if you probably know if that's actually apocryphal, but I thought it was, he's like talking to Divine and saying, we should do a movie where you eat shit. And that sort of becomes, is that really true? Or is that just kind of like, whatever?
There's truth to it. But.
Yeah, it felt a little bit like pat. But regardless of the fact that, you know, there's so much repugnant stuff in Pink Flamingos, I find it has its charm, its John Waters-ness to it, but I don't rush to go back and watch it that much, despite loving his entire, you know, the group of actors that he uses all the time, basically, his stable.
The Dreamlanders?
The Dreamlanders, yes, exactly. I love all those people, and... I just realized that I love them even more in Female Trouble. So I don't know. But yeah, I love his dialogue. I mean, you could slice just about any section of this movie out and there's some incredibly awesome piece of dialogue.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to set fire to this dump. Just because we're pretty, everybody's jealous. It's like a prison here. Even at Christmas, it's like a prison. Don't even mention Christmas, Chicklet. My parents are going to be real sorry if I don't get them cha-cha heels. I asked and I better get. I never get enough Christmas presents. Everybody's so damn cheap. I should be getting a lot. And I'm going to take it all back and get the money for it. You can do that, you know. We'll probably get caught for hooking this period, but who cares? Who cares if we fail? It'd be fun to be expelled. I hope I get arrested. I hate this school and all these ignorant teachers who don't know one thing. I'm the one who should be teaching. I hate my parents too.
No, he's a big reader, and I always feel like that helps out so much with writing. And he would defend all of his actors too, and people would call them amateur. He's like, well, you try reciting my dialogue. They'll do it in one take.
Yeah, no, he gives them long speeches, especially Divine will get these like big long bits to do. I feel like there's nothing I love more than a director actor combo where, you know, the director is really making a movie to showcase his actor, or, you know what I mean? Like, there's a synergy, and Divine and him are one for the ages. You know, they're De Niro, Scorsese, they are, you know, just name any actor that goes with any director, you know, and like Dietrich von Sternberg. I mean, you can go wherever you want with it. I think he and Divine are right there, especially after you watch Female Trouble, because I feel like it's such an amazing showcase for her and him, excuse me. And I was reminded why I like him, you know? I don't know.
And Divine was my Elizabeth Taylor, and I've said that before, but it's true. Divine loved Elizabeth Taylor. He looked up to him. And the hairdos and everything in this are, in a way, certainly influenced by Elizabeth Taylor.
Certainly.
No, it was an amazing relationship. And Waters said that this is one of his favorite films of himself, but it's his favorite of Divine's.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of funny you brought up some of those combinations, because they did have that relationship where there was a lot of love. They were childhood friends, but John Waters would always put him through his paces. And it's right there on screen. You know, he'd make him go through cold water in the middle of winter and wear underwear like in the middle of the forest. he wouldn't like make things easy on Divine, but
have sex with himself.
Yeah,
I think that's more impressive and funny and awesome than eating shit in Pink Flamingos is him having the dual role in this movie, which I love dual roles, by the way.
Yeah, me too.
And he's so
like Betty Davis.
Oh yeah. He's so good in it, though. He's so good in both sides. And the final like confrontation with Mink Stole, who, by the way, this might be my favorite Mink Stole too. I think she's just amazing in this movie.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. I was going through my roles of her because I love her so much.
Well, she's great in Serial Mom too, actually. I mean, you know, there's some of the best stuff. But yeah, I mean, I just like the Divine, the Mink Stole. I mean, these people just go with Waters so perfectly. I love that. I can't get enough of it. Every time I watch his movies, I'm just like, there was an initial part of me that was like, oh, he found some outcasts. Isn't that cute? But then the more I watched it, the more I'm like, no, this is like cinematic gold. This is, every time.
No, well, he was smart enough to realize that in Baltimore, especially in that time period, he was surrounded by gold. He wasn't like dreaming of going to New York City or Los Angeles to make these movies. He looked around and he's like, well, this is interesting to me. It'd probably be interesting to other people. And he was right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I love his devotion to Baltimore. I love that. Is it like basically almost all his films take place there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's something about that city that, you know, I love LA and it's great to see it in movies, but I just love too when a filmmaker like plants a flag in the ground, especially geographically, which you don't see that much, and that becomes part of their aesthetic too. You know, you've got the cast of actors, you've got the location, you've got his sense of humor, put it all together and you get something that's not like anything else and never will be, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a huge part of his appeal. And it's really impressive because if you look at multiple Maniacs and let's say a Dirty Shame or Cecil B. Demented, they look nothing alike. They're pretty far apart in time, but it still has a signature on it.
Yeah, you know what? I haven't watched those close together and now I kind of want to after watching, because I watched Female Trouble a couple times in about a week, which I don't usually do. I don't usually have time.
But so fun.
Oh,
I don't
blame you. No, it's so fun. And I was getting into all the extras and that was making me want to go back, and listening to his commentary was making me want to go back. So what do you think of the, well, I guess we talked about Mink Stole. I think her character,
Taffy Davenport.
Yes. Great name.
Yes. Divine is Dawn Davenport, the juvenile delinquent, and we follow her. She grows up. And Suzanne Lowe, who was in the cast, was pregnant. You can see her pregnant in the movie. And Divine gives birth to her actual baby that she just had.
That scene is insane.
It is insane.
Oh, now I just got it. I just figured out what you were talking about, the connections.
Well, that's one of them. But yeah, I'm glad you picked up on it.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, that scene's amazing. Yeah, I love the... So yeah, I mean, the story is just of Dawn Davenport and her sort of rise to fame, I guess. And then...
The beautiful crime.
Yes. But I love how he sort of chapter marks it, you know, like the different years and the different period of her life.
Young Dawn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What is it, Miss Holland?
Mr. Weinberger, Dawn Davenport is eating a meatball sandwich right out in class, and she's been passing notes.
I was not eating.
I got a knife here in my pocketbook, and I'm going to cut you up after class.
Stop this immediately.
Now they're threatening me, these awful cheap girls. My mother told me to report this kind of thing. I'm trying to get an education.
All of you, stop it. Dawn Davenport, stand up.
I'm trying to get an education so I can get to a good college. It's not fair.
That will be all. You were quite proper in reporting this incident, but that will be enough.
She was trying to copy my homework.
That's untrue, and you know it.
Dawn Davenport, you are a habitual liar, and I'm quite well aware of it. You will go to detention for a month for this.
I won't go. I wasn't eating.
From your appearance, Miss Davenport, it looked like you never stopped eating. Get up here. I'll write 50 times on this blackboard, I will not eat you back.
I'm bad enough already.
But yeah, and then, you know, there's two actors that play her, well, three if you count the baby, but two main actors that play her daughter. And there's also a really fun interview with the little girl, not Mink Stole, but the little girl who plays her daughter that likes to jump rope and annoy her, which is a great scene. But it was fun to listen to John Waters talk to this woman about her memories of the production. And he seemed to be fishing for, like, having scarred her as a child.
Yeah, are you okay? Do you remember that being scary?
She's just like, no.
It was great.
Yeah. Every single question is like, no, it's fine. And he really is trying to get something about, like, or maybe he was hoping that he didn't scar her and he just wanted to make sure.
No, there was genuine affection, which was why it was so fun. I think at one point he's even like, you were fed, right? Like, you were never hungry on set.
And the other thing I liked seeing on this disc, and I'm kind of going all over here, but like, there's some, like, I think it's Super 8 or 16 footage of John Waters directing. And he does a little commentary over the footage. Is that what that was, if I recall?
Yes. And that, for like a big fan like me, where I'll go on my way to see his lectures and I'll watch interviews with him. So I know his stories pretty well. He sounded like he was genuinely disarmed by seeing that footage. Like, he hadn't watched it in a long time, and he was taken aback at seeing how young everyone was and people who had passed away a long time ago seeing them again. Like, I think not just seeing photos or seeing them in the film, but actually, like, behind the scenes, it really sounded like it affected him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's actually kind of an extra added hook to that whole feature is the emotional aspect, and the fact that the kind of characters he ran/runs with, I guess a lot of them lived lifestyles that, you know, led to, in some cases, premature demises, which is sad, but they all burned really brightly. You know what I mean? Like, they are true characters. And yeah, anyway, so I love the progression of the little girl Taffy to the Mink Stole Taffy, and especially the fact that he brought in his, I guess, autobiographical bit of, like, her playing car accident in the house.
I did that kind of stuff, too. I would, like, tie up my Barbie dolls, and I'd put them on one of the ski tracks on a Nordic track and pretend she was, like, going towards a whirling blade. I'd be like, you're going to have to talk, Barbie, or you're going to get it. So yeah, related.
That's awesome. That is awesome. But your mom didn't take you to junkyards, apparently, like John Waters did.
No.
That's so awesome. He's just telling all these little stories about. He's
and
like,
have you seen his parents?
I feel like I have, but not recently. So now I have to look up a picture of them.
Yeah, just the most old-fashioned, very like pinned up, perfect-looking people. So I love the. I could just see her like picking her way over there in her like white heels, like taking little John Waters to the junkyard. Oh, it's so great.
Yeah, it's he's something else.
There's this great portrait of them all sitting together.
All right, I'll have to find that one. What about Edith Massey? Talk to me about Edith Massey. Definitely a John Waters character through and through.
Yeah, definitely. She worked in a bar, and he discovered her. And then she ended up running a thrift store that was really popular, but kind of doubled as her fan club. And it's just the kind of place where people would wander in to take pictures and autographs with her. If they like would put their coat down, she would just sell their coat to someone else.
I found a nice clip of him talking about that thrift shop and how...
And she did know what she was doing. People thought she didn't. I remember when the Newsweek review came out of Polyester, it said that she either deserved an Oscar or the 24-hour nurse. And I read it to her, and she said, I'd like both, actually. And Edie and I used to do this kind of date together, and we'd drive by car, and she would drive me crazy because she would say out loud every single thing she saw. We'd be driving along, she'd say... Car, house, lawn, pretty lady, red car, telephone pole, lawn, lawn, lawn. I said, Edith! No, it was just internalization was a concept she was very unfamiliar with. And my favorite memory of Edith is she had a thrift shop, Edith's shopping bag, and she only sold what people gave her. She never bought anything. So in the summer, it would be dead months, and she'd be sitting there in Baltimore, August, really hot. And so she would just go through the garbage and gift wrap aspirin bottle tops and everything, and then have a grab bag, 25 cents. But it was all garbage that she was going to throw out. So the little kids from the projects would run down and say, Miss Edie, what's in there? And then they'd buy one, they'd open it and say, what the hell is this? And she'd say, can't be lucky every day.
Like there is a good mystery package that they missed out on that had different garbage in it. She's incredible. I mean, one of those people that apparently he sort of loved her, but like found her difficult to work with. Like, it's amazing that he could get her to deliver some of the lengthy speeches that she has to do. Cause
right.
Clearly
and you can
it's not
tell.
Easy. Yeah. It's not easy for her like to do that stuff. So yeah, I can't imagine how hard it must've been to get her to do some of the dialogue in Female Trouble. Cause it's long scenes, some of them, you know?
Yeah, that's another thing I really respect about John Waters is if he thought you were an interesting person, he put more importance on that than your acting ability.
Yeah.
But there is this great documentary called Love Letter to Edie.
Oh.
That it's just great. It has footage of the store. So if you found her intriguing at all, but yeah, she had a good amount of dialogue in this, but in Desperate Living and Polyester, I think she had even more. So
I think you're right.
John Waters put a lot of faith in her.
Gator, what a coincidence. There's somebody here dying to meet you. Ernie, this is Gator. Gator, this is Ernie.
Hi, Studs.
Get him out of here.
Gator Nelson, you be polite to Ernie. He wants a date with you.
Well, I don't want a date with him. I came to say goodbye, Ann Otto. I'm moving to Detroit.
What?
I want to be near the auto industry. I'm sick of hairdressing, and besides, Dawn had me fired.
I can get you a job in the bath, Mary.
Look, fucker, take a walk, all right?
Well.
Look, you better be it before I punch your fucking face out that window.
No gay knots for me, Ida. At best, all you've got is trade.
Oh, Gator, Ernie's your type. Move back in with me. And we'll get you a job as a female impersonator.
His hands are too big, darling. Bye, Gator. It was fab meeting you.
Fuck you. You're worse than my wife.
You can't leave.
Well, I am.
Oh, Gator, I'm sorry about Ernie. I thought you'd be cute together. Anybody's better than Don Slavenport.
You'll be all right, Aunt Ida. I'm just sick of everything here. I'm going to Detroit and find happiness within the auto industry.
No, Gator, no, I'll die. die if you leave. No, no, Gator, no.
All right,
please,
Aunt
don't
Ida.
Go.
Goodbye.
No, no, Gator, no. Ah, no, no, no. Ah, Gator, no, no. Ah, ah, no, no. Ah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure those were tough shoot days, and I would imagine there's a lot of frustration on both sides, but I think what comes out of it is kind of magic in its own way. I mean, Divine is like, he's a machine. Like, he just like powers through that dialogue and delivers it in this way that I don't think I've, there's something about the inflection and the, I guess, anger that he delivers a lot of the lines, the irritation that he has, basically. It's almost like humorous, though, that he's so irritated all the time with everyone.
Well, it's so funny how well he sells being a teenage girl.
Really does. That Christmas scene is pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, it's legendary. They recreated it on RuPaul's Drag Race and everything.
I love the line she delivers about,
I'm going to go sink into a long, hot beauty bath now and try to erase the stink of a 5-year marriage. Someone at such a tender age as you, Taffy, might find it difficult to understand what a long, hard, painful decision this was on my part. I'm a free woman now, and my life is just ready to begin.
Just, there's so many great bits. But again, it's like Sam Jackson and Tarantino, that dialogue is even better when she says it. And I would say, you know, Edith Massey has her own way of, you know, bringing the dialogue to life in a way that's, I don't know, it's a little uncomfortable, but...
Well, she was a character. Divine was a star.
Yeah, she definitely supports well, you know, like if it's just Divine, I think it's still a good movie, but there's so many other great supporting players that it just, yeah, man, I was really blown away. Like, I was really like, man, I had underrated this movie, and it was kind of delightful to get to, well, I think I've not been able to talk about any of the, I guess there's only been one other one so far. Is it just in terms of Criterion releases of on Blu-ray?
This is the second Criterion.
Yeah, and I'm hoping this is a trend. I'm hoping
so much.
Right? It seems like they don't do things willy-nilly. Like, they don't just, oh, let's one-off a couple Joan Waters movies. I'm going to guess. I mean, they've already done Polyester on Laserdisc, so that seems like, why wouldn't you, you know, do it on Blu-ray? And then Desperate Living.
Don't I own that?
What? Oh, why don't you own the Laserdisc? I think it, but you know what? I think the DVD came with the Odorama card, too, now that I think about it.
I have that, but okay. The Laserdisc.
You should be able to get it relatively cheap. It's pretty cool looking. Yeah, it's definitely worth a pickup. But yeah, I don't want to say, I think you had started to remind me how much I like John Waters in the past year or so. And I guess, like, because I remember when I was in college, I bought, you know, Shock Value, and I loved it. And I think I have an audio file of it somewhere of him reading it, which I absolutely adore.
My parents claim they suspected something was wrong with me from the beginning, and my childhood obsession with car accidents seemed to confirm their worst fears. While other kids were out playing cowboys and Indians, I was lost in fantasies of crunching metal and people screaming for help. I would sweet-talk unsuspecting relatives into buying me toy cars. As soon as I was alone, I would rush out to my favorite place, a tree stump surrounded by mud located in an obscure section of the woods near our house. Here was my own little fantasy world, a child's version of an auto collision center. I would take two cars and pretend they were driving on a secluded country road until one would swerve and crash into the other. I would become quite excited and start smashing the car with a hammer, all the while shouting, "Oh my God, there's been a terrible accident!" Another childhood obsession related to violence in my mind was amusement parks. I've always loved scary rides, and to this day, I'll drive hundreds of miles to go on a roller coaster if I've read that someone has recently been killed while riding it. If I could pick my own death, it would be on a roller coaster that jumps the tracks and careens into a packed crowd at a cotton candy stand at the state fair.
And I just was really into him in college. It was like Jim Jarmusch and I'm trying to think of some of the other low... I really responded to low-budget filmmaking when I was in college, because I was like, oh, this is doable. This is something, I mean, I can't.
Attainable.
Exactly. I can't write John Waters dialogue or Jim Jarmusch dialogue, but I can make something cheaply and try and be clever in the dialogue and whatever. I think Tarantino was around that time too, but yeah, I just remember just really being into John Waters and cult movies around that time, and then kind of over the years letting it, my love of him slip just ever so slightly. Not personally, because every time I saw him interviewed, I was like, oh, I love that guy. But just in terms of coming back to the films, I think I had stopped doing that, you know? So yeah. This has just reinvigorated me 100%, you know? And listening to the commentary where, you know, he's talking about, you know, Divine being his Liz Taylor and, you know, how he said something about like cults becoming families.
I'm not interested in brainwashing anybody, but I find it... Well, cults have always fascinated me.
Pretty. Yeah!
Groups of people that become more dysfunctional families in a militant way together has always been what my movies are about. They're all about that.
Well, that was a big part of what informed him a lot about writing this movie. The Manson trial was going on. He was visiting Tex in prison a lot. And all of that just started percolating within him. And that's why we have like the big trial scene and we have a big prison scene. And I love that the prison used the gas chamber, but John Waters wanted the visual of an electric chair. So they built their own electric chair and just hauled it into the prison. Like, no, it's okay. We're just filming a movie. It's fine.
Yeah. He was talking about like them dragging this electric chair across the yard and seeing the prisoners like looking like what the fuck is going on. That's got to be terrifying. But yeah, I love that it's like a mixture of those things. And then in one of the interviews on the disc, he talks about the movie I Want to Live, I think, with Susan Hayward.
They'll all die violently. The spies, the liars, all the ones who want me dead. I'm innocent. All I can think of was that I couldn't prove my alibi.
Mrs. Graham.
I was going to the gas chamber.
Please,
and I was
Mrs.
desperate.
Graham, you'll have to...
Have you
Mrs.
ever
Graham,
been desperate?
Mrs. Graham!
You know what it's like!
Which is like this sort of prison melodrama, and I think he talks about Boom, the Liz Taylor and Richard Burton movie, which I still haven't seen, which I need to see very soon, potentially for another show topic. Yeah,
Wow, in front of me.
No, it's a different thing. It's not about not. I just really want to watch it. And he reminded me, because I've heard him talk about Boom on more than one occasion, and I've always been like, oh, I should really watch that. Now I really need to after hearing him talk. But yeah, just the mix of influences from John Waters, like real personal life and the movies that he loved. I just think he is fascinating as a cauldron.
And the time period, like Deep Throat came out, so nudity wasn't, it was becoming more common. But he's like, okay, I'll just show close-ups of male nudity. No, it's really doing that.
Yeah, there's definitely, I can't imagine what this movie would have been like to see then, because it's still kind of jarring now, you know, because I think we're used to, you know, a lot of quote-unquote politically correct kind of, even raunchy comedies I feel like have nothing on him. Like, he just really goes to the edge and beyond in just about every scene. Any scene that you're like, oh, I think I've seen a scene like this before, suddenly he'll add some, you know, outlandish bit of dialogue or something ridiculous, like beating a child with a car aerial or, you know, whatever. It's so amazing, though.
It is. Yeah. You mentioned Pink Flamingos. It's interesting because I have a very similar feeling to you about that film, which I love it and admire it. But it's really not that high up on my favorites with him. And I don't revisit it very much either. But it was such a gigantic hit. And Female Trouble didn't do nearly as well as Pink Flamingos, even though I think it's a much better film.
Me too. But he was saying it wasn't... it wasn't really a midnight movie either. It was, he said it had opened in like some relatively regular theater and not a midnight thing. And I was like, how could this not? It just seems like such an amazing cult movie that would have people reciting dialogue along with it. You know what I mean? Like just proto, not Rocky Horror, but proto movies that you would go and see and just want to participate in, just roll around in, you know? Mm-hmm. Just blows my mind.
Yeah, but it was hard for him because he's like, well, everyone just talks about the poop eating and I can't just keep escalating that. So he focused on the ideals that were shocking rather than the actions. But then, of course, we look at it now like people committing crime and disfiguring themselves for fame. And you're like, oh, you're always ahead of, ahead of the curve, John.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely... I was just thinking about the gigantic, I don't know if they're like hair nets or whatever the heck they wear when the girls like are robbing people because they don't want to mess up their hair. So it would be like a stocking, but it's a gigantic stocking so that it goes all the way over their coiffures, as it were.
Ooh, nice pull.
Yeah, it's just hilarious, those scenes. And then, of course, later, I don't want to give anything away for those that haven't seen Female Trouble. Definitely watch it. I think it's on Filmstruck if you really aren't going to get this Blu-ray, but you should. There's a, like you said, a physical scarring that happens that it's, I don't know, it's pretty crazy. It makes for some great scenes of, is the scene where she's like sort of wandering around in front of people, is that before or after the scarring? I can't remember right now.
It's after. And okay. John was like, he did that purposely. He's like, okay, we're going to have another Divine walking down the actual street, freaking out the squares. But he thought because of the makeup that people assumed that Divine was, you know, disabled in some way. So people weren't going to make her feel bad about herself because she's obviously been through a lot. So in the movie, people aren't really reacting as much as you might think they would.
Yeah, no, they aren't.
So it kind of backfired on him.
It's still an amazing sequence. Like,
oh,
I love a good, like, it's almost like a dream sequence, but it's not. It's just like a character, like, basically dancing around to music in the streets. It's like his, like, West Side Story scene or something. But he picked the perfect song, and seeing her, she's incredibly cinematic in so many ways. And it's just a delightful scene. I was just like... The movie already had me re-won over at that point, but when I got to that scene, I was like, oh man, that is amazing. So it's, goddamn
it's
good.
Such a great glimpse of, it really shows kind of what they were working with and against. And one of the wonderful things about him is you see these people, they're just normal people. They're wearing like brown warm clothes because it's Baltimore and it's cold, and they're just kind of sitting there, and all of a sudden Divine in like a skin tight little leopard dress comes like waltzing through, and it's a shocking jolt of unexpected joy through all this mundanity. And it's wonderful. You're right, like that is pure cinema.
Totally is. Nicely done. Nicely done. Let's talk briefly about the extras. We've talked about the rare onset footage. We've talked a little bit about the commentary and a little bit about the new... Did you like the new conversation between Waters and critic Dennis Lim?
I did. It was kind of funny because Dennis is a very... he's a very like straight-laced, calm person. And yes. John was wearing him down a little bit at the end. He got him to crack a few smiles.
It was
pretty
funny.
The dichotomy was pretty interesting. Oh, and I do want to mention that it's the same commentary that was on the DVD. They didn't record a new one.
Which is maybe too bad, but, you know, I mean, he's only got so much to say, I suppose, you know.
Yeah, he in my opinion, I've said this before, he is the king of commentary. Not only does he just seem to have the most amazing memory, but he delivers it in such a fun way. It's never dry.
No. Yeah, I would... He's definitely the kind of guy where you're like, oh, man, I'd like to watch every movie with John Waters. Even if he talked over the whole thing, I wouldn't care.
No, I remember when the Mommy Dearest DVD came out, I was like, oh, I should finally see that. John Waters commentary! Bless whoever put this together.
That is one of the great special features ever. That is something else right there. I enjoyed the like public access interview from, I guess, 75 or something like that, mm-hmm. with Waters and with Divine Minkstole and David Lockery is pretty fun. Pretty fun stuff.
I'm so used to retrospectives. Seeing them actually talk to people in 1975 explaining it is great.
Yeah, and it's funny because the guy is really enthusiastic, but it definitely feels like a cable access show. We'll say that. Because at the end, he says something like, okay, everybody do your commercial for the movie or something. And they're just like, what?
Is there anything else you would like to say about your movie? And they're just like lounging, looking so cool. And they're like, excuse me.
Waters looks too cool. Waters is almost too cool, except for the fact that he's got what sounds to be like a terrible cold. And he's smoking cigarettes, which is like, I just kept being like, oh, John, that's got to be terrible.
It's rough. And Divine looks like she's straight out of Grey Gardens.
Oh, totally. Such a little Edie look. That's good stuff. Yeah, I like that one a lot. And then I feel like there was, are there any other interviews that you really dug or any other features that you really dug on this? I mean, it's a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, they had archival interviews, and I've always kind of been fascinated with Marion Vivian Pierce. And she's the one who, she always looks vaguely like Marilyn Monroe in these movies. But she hate, like, unlike pretty much everyone else involved in these films, she hated attention, and she would just basically travel the world to avoid like any kind of attention. And even it's like a sliver of an interview, and I feel like maybe a lot of people who don't follow John Waters were like, oh, okay, but for me I was like, oh, it's footage of her talking as herself, like,
wow,
it was
cool.
Way too exciting for me.
I missed that one. I got to go back and look at that. I don't know much about her.
She did well then.
That was her name. Yes, indeed. But overall, a pretty awesome Criterion disc. I think we'd both agree, right?
Yes, I am incredibly greedy with all John Waters things, and I was very satisfied with this. I really, really, really hope they keep releasing these. Yeah. I think a lot of people are going to discover them. And I hope, like you mentioned about You in College, it keeps inspiring filmmakers and people who have to work with low budgets, because they had like a $25,000 budget for this. And
wow.
And I love that it shows chances. It's like, you know, there's a lot of movies I love where it's two guys sitting in a room talking. That can be great. But you can also just go completely insane and on a small budget. And I think that's such a great thing about John Waters' early career, is that just do it. Just work with what you have. A lot of people won't understand it, but if you really believe in it and you're putting the work in, please do it.
And make it personal. Put your own
yes.
personality and sense of humor, and find, you know, those crazy friends that are kindred spirits and put them in the movie. I mean, it's just such a familial process, you know, in this way. And yeah, I don't know. There's just such a warmth. Like you said, there's something about that that really makes you feel like, as much as I'm sure that a lot of them individually were ridiculed and ostracized, you can tell that when they're together, they are this unit, and you want to be a part of that unit with them, you know? So it's kind of this amazing, like, victory that you're watching, and you can't help but get sort of caught up in it, I guess.
Yeah, just a few decades later, like, the most acclaimed, like, film releasing company does a beautiful edition, a beautiful restoration, like, pictures of them in outfits they probably got picked on. They're in art galleries now.
Isn't that amazing? I love
it. It's amazing. I think it's really inspiring.
Yeah, I think, well, here's my thing. I think we're going to see Polyester, and we're going to see Desperate Living, because those are New Line / Warner Brothers owned, and it just seems to make sense, right? Mm-hmm. So when those come out, we're going to talk about them on the show. It just has to be. So
thank you.
Set aside the time.
Those are other ones if you did them with anyone else.
Oh, ooh, boy. That'd be just silly. Come on.
Unless you can get John.
Well, that would be incredible. That would be incredible. I'd love to do that. It's one of my sort of dreams, is to just talk to him once in my life.
Yes.
I don't know what I would say, because I'm sure a lot of people are so devoted to him and probably have been saving up some interesting or weird thing to say to him for like 20 years and I got nothing. So I'm sure I'll just totally underwhelm at any point that I would see
him. Well, then you should really have me there if it ever
exactly.
happens.
Exactly. You should be there. In fact, I'll just watch while you meet him and then that's probably going to be the best thing. Great. Ultimately.
So, oh, I'm sorry. Patrick, our friend Patrick Bromley has a big crush on Cookie Mueller, who's been also in this movie, and he just wanted me to mention her. Oh, it's thanks to her that John Waters came up with the title Female Trouble. Because when she's in the hospital, he's like, so what happened? She said, female trouble, and they both laughed.
Oh, that's right.
Remember that, yeah.
She is pretty cute. She's pretty
she
cute.
Is.
Yeah.
She looks like the girls that made my life hell in like middle school and high school, but yeah.
Yeah. We should take a moment to mention you brought up Mr. Bromley. You were recently on the FS Movie podcast talking about some Canadian exploitation films, the Screwballs.
Yeah,
Screwballs movies. Scroobles movies, and you did one about Empire Pictures, so people should go and listen to those episodes if they have not already. I'm sure that they have. I meant to do that at the top of the show, but that's called disorganization and being scattered. So
hey, we're talking about John Waters. There are no rules right now.
That's true. That's true. But so anyway, this disc is great. Definitely, you know, towards the top of my favorite releases of the year so far. And like I said, I watched the movie twice inside of a week, partially because I wanted to be prepared for the show and because I knew I'd be talking to you, but also because it was super fun and I just really enjoyed the whole experience. So definitely pick this one up. This should come out while the Barnes & Noble sale is still going on, so just slap this baby in your cart with whatever else you're getting and bring it on home, I think.
Yeah, you won't regret it. But if you do, just give it to one of your cooler friends, and they'll appreciate it.
Exactly. Or your kids. You know, I'll give mine
well,
to
Raven. Show them Hairspray first, and then you can.
I really got to do that. Like, seriously, I want to get Raven into John Waters.
No, I was really young when I first saw that. Yeah, there's nothing objectionable in it at all.
That's cool. I think she'll get a kick out of it. It's one of those where I'm like, I'm always trying to think of fun and interesting things to show her, and I don't know why I didn't think to do that already. So, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Thank you, John Waters.
Exactly. All right, so moving on to something kind of even crazier than Female Trouble, and not necessarily all in a good way, but definitely unique, and that is Extro from, I want to say 1982.
Tony's father has been away a long time. Now, he's coming home. Extro has returned. Once a man, he is now something more than human. Indestructible, ever-changing, evil. His mission, to avenge, to possess, to destroy.
Why did you come back?
I came back for you.
Oh, my God! Joe!
Extro, bearing powers of black magic from deep space.
If you think hard about something, you can make it happen. Use it when you need it.
Some extraterrestrials aren't friendly. From New Line Cinema, rated R.
You sounded so unsure just saying the title. Extro?
I think. Yes, Extro from 1982 is... I think it's one of the movies that you can kind of point to and go, hey, do you like movies that are completely bonkers? You need to watch this movie because it's one of the craziest movies you're ever going to see, I think. I don't know how you felt about rewatching. I'm assuming you'd seen it already, or were you watching it for the first time?
No, I had seen it.
I figured. So were you reminded how crazy it is in this rewatch?
Well, yes, I was. And yeah, if you have a friend who they're like, oh, I'm kind of jaded, like everything's kind of boring. Like, have you seen Extra? No? Okay. That will snap them right out of that fugue state.
You are so right.
Okay. I have to admit, I have seen Extra before. It was only last year. I rented it from the only video store still open, Las Vegas. It was the DVD with Extra 1 and 2 on it.
Oh, I haven't seen Extra 2.
It's so disappointing because this one is bonkers original, just aggressively original. And people like to throw around something as an alien or aliens ripoff on like every movie with an alien or maybe a spaceship in it. That's just the go-to thing to say about it. I just want people to understand I'm not doing that right now. Extra 2 is the Alien ripoff. I mean, just imagine Alien made with like no passion. And there you go. So it's so strange that it's a sequel to this. But yeah, I was well aware of some of the scenes and that people would constantly talk about how crazy it was. So I was like, okay, yeah, I'm ready for this. I was not ready for it.
It's difficult to prepare for Extra. I mean, it's one of the giant gems of what the fuck cinema. I'd seen it too, but in rewatching it again, and it was just today I finished rewatching it, and I was like, wow. For those that don't know, it's basically the story of this family wherein the father was abducted by aliens, I guess, at the beginning of the movie, which is like within the first 5 minutes. It's super weird because it's like this kid playing with his dad, and then suddenly this bright light comes over them and his dad gets pulled away, and
it's almost like he throws something. It looks like he just rips open like space-time and gets sucked in or something. Yeah. Nothing is ever like clearly laid out to you, and there's no like exposition movie like this is why Norman Bates did this. No, like, good luck, you are on your own. If you don't like exposition, watch Extra. You'll not have to worry about it.
No, they aren't too long in the tooth with the exposition in this movie. Yeah, I do like that. I was listening to, and I don't know if it's on we're talking about the Second Sight Blu-ray. But I also just recently got a German, like, Ultimate Blu-ray, you know, last year, I think.
Was that four discs?
Yeah, it was the one with the soundtrack and all that crap. But I had to get this one, too. But there's a little bit in this interview where the director is talking about... What was he? He was talking about how they had to... They had fallen behind schedule and they had to start taking pages out of the script, and how that may contribute to the slight... lack of continuity in the movie.
And things there are like, some places where you're like, oh, did I sit on the remote? Did I like fast forward a little bit?
Totally. But it's one of those things where it's like, whatever, you know, sort of alchemy made this movie come together is an amazing, you know, thing. The big signature scene in the movie, and it happens really early, and actually there's several now that I rewatched that I'm like, wow, this scene's pretty amazing too. But there's a scene where a woman gives birth to a full-grown man, and he kind of tears her apart as he comes out, and it's gross and weird and just leaves you with your mouth hanging open.
The camera does not pull away from this scene.
No, I mean, it's like American Werewolf in London. Like, they, and it's not as well lit as that. Clearly, they wanted to keep this a little more in the dark. But
they're British. Then you had to clap it up. That movie was like fake British.
It's true. Yeah. But yeah, that scene's amazing. That happens early on. But then there's all kinds of scenes where, I mean, basically the dad comes back. And in the meantime, the mom has sort of gotten a new boyfriend who's like a fashion photographer or some bullshit. And they have their son, and they have like a nanny, I guess. Miriam Dabo plays a kind of a nanny to the kid.
Their French nanny.
Their French nanny who has a lot of nudity in the film, which is
there's just a very European view of sex in this movie.
Definitely. And it's okay to do when there's a child at home. You can just them go play, apparently. So anyway.
But yeah, I'm sorry. It's no, just you'll hear a lot that, like, you know, here in America we'll show violence and gore, you know, but no sex. And in Europe they'll show sex, but not really gore. Extra's like, just pile them in.
Fuck you. We'll do both. Yeah, Extra's totally not.
Get you an extra who can do both.
Yeah, okay, so the dad comes back after 3 years. He's kind of like, it's unclear if he's actually himself or what, but he seems to retain all the memories of things he did with the wife and the son in this way that you're like, okay, I guess maybe he's not an alien transplant, or is he? I don't want to give anything away. But then there's like these scenes where the people that are infected by the alien thing will suck on another person and make them all gross and veiny and bulbous, and
those are some uncomfortable scenes.
Yeah, super weird. And then the son gets powers and he can bring his toys to life, and one of them is this dwarf man, this little person that is kind of evil. And
he's just a clown. Of course he's evil. You're going to skim over him being a clown.
I forgot for a second. Clown. He is an evil clown.
I wish I could forget.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's almost like a scene out of like Living in Oblivion, except they don't make what's his name's character a clown, but they use him in that way as like a dream sequence thing. Anyway, it's a super weird character. I can't see, even
Peter Dinklage, like, I'm not gonna play with this kid who's like has alien powers. It's not gonna happen. It just walks off. Yes.
I love it.
Thank you. That helps me cope with the clown aspect. I appreciate that.
Thinking as Dinklage's character in Living in Oblivion. Yes, uh-huh, I think exactly. That works.
He was actually hired on first and he wasn't having it.
Yeah. No, this actor has kind of a Dinklage vibe, actually. And maybe
he's having a good time.
Yeah. Maybe he's wearing a similar hat, I think, to the character in Living in Oblivion. Maybe that's what's getting me. I can't remember. But that's weird. And then the kid's got like psychic abilities to move things around. And his dad's like, you know, use your powers wisely. You'll know when to use them. And you're like, oh, okay, that's some nice advice. And then the kid doesn't really do that at all.
And I love it at the beginning. It's almost like he's like, no, stop, don't.
It's just, wow. And it just kind of gets progressively more and more nuts as more people get kind of taken over by the alien. And it's got a killer ending. And the effects are, they're like just good enough for me. And they're practical in this wonderful, gross way that they all look like slimy and sticky enough that I'm like, ew. Which is the proper response, I think. Yeah, I don't know. So what are your impressions upon rewatch of Extra outside of like, man, this movie's fucking nuts?
Well, first I would just like to mention how I think that was your most trepidatious like plot summary you've ever done.
It's horrible.
Because every sentence seemed to end in a question. Like, did that actually happen?
Well, I mean, there's uncertainty when you're watching this movie, clearly.
No, it's completely understandable. It made me feel better. The first time I saw this, a lot of the weirdness was shock. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't understand the pacing was going to be the way it was. I had no idea it would be quite as effects heavy as it was. So I was interested in revisiting again because I didn't have that shock anymore. I knew exactly what was going to happen. So I was curious about how I'd react to that. And it was almost weirder watching it again.
Yeah.
Because you're like, okay, well, of course, I've never seen this before. It's going to be strange. But once that veil of shock is gone and you can really focus on like, wow, this was a choice. Look at that was a choice. And you can really like dig into it. And it's just kind of great because I think we're in a great time period for film right now. I think there is so much wonderful work coming out, but this one is so audacious and weird, and you don't really see that very often, of just going completely in to that level of insanity very often.
No. No, like
this
I said,
is commitment to something.
I mean, by the end, it feels like Fulci isn't quite right, but there's something with like a dash of Fulci. I mean, because it just gets so nuts. There's a great story I found in the features on the other disc, and I'll ask you about your thoughts on the features on this disc, where the director was talking about the... At one point, there's a Black Panther, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that appears in the movie. I'm not going to explain why. But he talked about the behind the scenes of that and how the entire crew was like in a cage.
We, the crew, the camera people, we were in a cage. We were in the cage. And the Panther had to jump.
To be safe from the Panther?
Yes.
Oh.
And there was a man with a shotgun.
Really, just in case?
Yeah, and the Panther was over there. It was over there. And it was supposed to jump up over us to attack the guy.
Yeah.
And then when it attacked the guy, it was going to be a puppet. So, okay, this was its big moment. And it had to go...
Black Panther puppet was created.
Exactly. But this particular Panther is an idle bastard. And we got into the cage. We were very excited. We took some beers in there.
Yeah.
It was a small box.
It was
like a little box which three or four people fitted into.
You could be in there for a while.
A little hole in the thing, and we were having a little drink in there.
Sure.
And the Panther was asleep. We had to wait for the Panther to wake up. And so we were drinking away, and the Panther goes up. Oh, dear. No, it's not quite good. Panther goes back. All right. And then this time, the chap elected the Panther trainer. Elected to stand on top of our little hide, right?
Mm-hmm.
On top of it, and shake a dead chicken with feathers to get it to come and grab it, right? And there's a man with a shotgun and everything, and the man here. And it did, it looked up, kind of stoned, and it saw this chicken, and it went for it, whoopsie. And the trouble is, as he was tempting the Panther, little chicken feathers came down in the frame. So as it's jumping, the chicken was going in. And then the worst thing was that then the Panther had eaten. So he didn't want to do anything for a while. And we had a few beers in our little cage.
In the cage.
In the cage.
Yeah.
And it was getting to the point where you had to do some recycling. It was very, very nasty.
No, and you had a beer.
No, we had plenty of beer.
Plenty of beer.
We had plenty of beer. But what we didn't have was disposal of the waste products.
Yes.
So that became unfair. Then we couldn't get out of the cage, you see. So anyway, the Panther comes out. I think we got it to do three times, and we were exploding. And that'll do. So, and then it took them ages to pull the damn cage apart. That's how we ran to the loo and all pissed together.
The director seems really tentative about the people that like this movie and that this movie has a following in general, which is too bad. You know, I think he's finally starting to embrace it, but I think there's a sense that he's like looking at it going, are they fucking with me? You know, this is, I don't know. I don't think this is a good movie that I made necessarily. And I feel like maybe they're fucking with me. But I have to say, I think it is... good movie is not the right word for what I want to express, but it is really unique and powerful in its own way. Like, you finish watching it, and you're just like, wow. And I don't mean that in a way that's totally just, like, dismissive wow. It's like a wow of, like, I have not seen another movie quite like that, and... that's pretty awesome, actually.
Yeah, I'm with you. When they announced this edition, I was incredibly excited. Like, I kind of freaked out because I hope I didn't sound dismissive talking about this movie. It's just hard to talk about without really, guys, it's really strange. Like, can you believe it? But I think it's a gorgeous film. The effects are... they're this perfect mix of disgusting because they're very well done and they're very imaginative. It's not really gore effects you really see elsewhere. The actors are incredible. And this is a script you really have to work with, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I feel like if this was the plot was the place, it would be a hedge maze.
Yeah.
And the actors were amazing. It's very natural. No, it's It's an enjoyable movie for me to revisit, but it's not one I can completely put on in the background, relax to, because, you know, you'll glance at it and it'll kind of just start pulling at your brain and chewing on it a little bit. And next thing you know, you're pulled right back in.
Yeah.
I think it's a very good movie, but not in a linear way. You need to work with it.
Yeah. No, it's intense. It's got an intensity to it.
It does. It is very intense.
I think part of that is what you're talking about with the actors, because at its core, it's really kind of like this family drama. It's like, we have a family unit, dad's been gone, dad comes back, and then there's this like tension with the boyfriend and with the mom, and then there are these flourishes of crazy fucking alien shit in that story. And I just can't think of too many other movies that try to do both of those things, especially with the type of performances that he's getting and the type of actors that he's using. Yeah, it's it just makes for this mix like nothing else I've ever seen.
Yeah, you almost could just split the family drama into a separate movie and all the alien stuff into a separate movie, and they would work independent of each other.
It kind of would, yeah. What did you think of the features on this one? There's like a 57-minute exploring extra piece. There's a 27-minute world of extra piece and some other shorter ones. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's great. You also get the soundtrack CD and a really nice booklet. I don't know if you had a chance to look through it, but it's really lovely. It has some essays and behind-the-scenes photographs.
Nice.
The extra exposed was on the like double DVD they had, but they edited out all mentions of extra too, which I kind of noticed throughout the extras that they if you didn't know about the sequels, they were fine with that. On this one.
That's funny.
The 57-minute documentary I thought was great, because this, well, people like us, we like learning about how all movies were made, but I feel like even if maybe that's not your interest, once you watch it, you're like, okay, what went on here?
Yeah.
And they really get into it. And I really liked the world of extra, which I think is what you're referring to about the director being uneasy with the passionate fans, because that one focuses on the fan.
Yeah.
And I really like extras that do that, that kind of acknowledge that the movie lives outside just the filmmakers and how it was received when it was originally released. And they talk about people like, oh, I saw it when I was 14. It changed my life.
They interviewed some chimney sweeps? That's awesome.
Wow, I thought that was a really authentic and non-offensive accent. But
no, I go right to Dick Van Dyke. It's my own, you know, my own thing. Yours is good. That's cool. No, I agree. That's definitely a feature you don't see enough of. And I think it can be done in a way that's can be a little off-putting. You know, I think you can find, I don't want to say the wrong fans, but I just think there's a way to do it that shows affection and doesn't make people that are fans of a weird movie look like freaks. You know, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it, but it is nice to acknowledge, like, hey, there's a reason this movie from 1982 has a couple special editions. It's because people fucking like it. And let's not pretend that this release exists in a vacuum and that there's no reason this is happening. Let's acknowledge the fans. And I think that's, like I said, I wish more discs would make a stab at doing that.
Yeah, plus you'll sell more copies. Like, their friends and family will have to buy it. So think about it.
Absolutely.
Labels. So there's four different cuts of the movie on
this. Well, now, talk to me about this. Like, I think I just watched the first one that you could pick, and I don't know what I missed out on.
Okay, so I'm so sorry if I get this wrong. I'm pretty sure I know what I'm talking about, but I do apologize. I rewatched it, and then I watched like kind of big chunks of all of them and the endings to compare them. But I guess, okay, there's the UK video version edit. The one labeled the alternate ending was actually the theatrical ending.
Okay.
But the director's cut one kind of, or the director's version. Did you watch any of that?
I only watched, like, you hit play on the disc and that was the cut I watched. So I didn't
watch. Okay, so you didn't.
I guess
it's so strange. He did something where he super saturated it, and it looks almost like he put like a blur photo filter over the movie. Weird. And sometimes when people are moving, it does. I've never seen this effect before, but it's almost like they come apart a little bit. Ooh. And then in one of the extras, he was talking about how the little boy actor gained weight while they were filming. So he went in and digitally slimmed him down in a few scenes.
Gosh.
So people complain about George Lucas. Wow. But I think Extro is going to be the new example of tinkering.
That's crazy. I totally didn't even notice the kid. Or if I did, I attributed it to like Alien, you know, the Alien 15, the weight gain you get.
When of course, the famous Alien 15.
Everybody knows about that. So I did not notice that at all. That's ridiculous that you would... I love the idea of trying to, like, I don't know, make this movie, like, look better or fine-tune it. I'm like, no, man, don't. You can't, I get that, like, you know, from his point of view, there's probably a lot of stuff he didn't get to put in and that would make the movie make more sense and whatever, but I'm just adamant about this. Like, you can't try to make this movie make more sense because then it loses some of the magic and that would be terrible.
Just, like, kind of change the look of it.
I don't get.
Not additional scene. No, I don't either. And at the end of the day, it's his film. He can do whatever they want, and they have the unaltered versions on there. So I actually love that it's on there because it's such a curiosity. If that was the only thing they made available, then we'd have an issue.
Yeah.
But it is a curiosity at this point. But I'm with you. And he even filmed a little introduction for it, and he wasn't very confident about it. He's like, I don't know if it's any better, but I wanted to change the lighting.
Now I feel bad. Poor guy.
It's like a 30-second introduction if you want to watch it. But I was like, oh boy, what's this going to look like?
What's wrong? Is it Joe?
Daddy's hurt.
What? Oh, God. Oh, my God. Oh, Joe!
Don't be frightened, Mum.
Where does it hurt? I won't be cross.
Don't worry, Mum.
Joe!
What's the matter?
Call a doctor.
Rice, what's he done?
Quickly! Annalise, get Annalise!
But overall, I was excited about this release. It's not female trouble or anything, but it is an interesting... No, wait, you said besides the childbirth scene... There were some other parallels. What other parallels did you come up with?
Well, I actually didn't say the childbirth scene. That's just when you realized
that. Oh, that was mine.
That.
Okay. So what are your parallels?
Oh, no. That was one of them. But okay. I haven't explained it to anyone listening. So right before this, I messaged Brian. I'm like, there are so many parallels between these two movies. Because we chose these movies basically because that's what I was getting and I was excited about.
Yep.
But it turns out they're almost the same movie.
Okay.
Sorry, I was just trying to sound clickbaity. Okay, so what Brian figured out when we were talking about Female Trouble is the giving birth scene in Female Trouble, Divine is just doing it by herself, going into labor on the couch. And once little baby Taffy comes out, Dawn Davenport cuts the umbilical cord herself with her teeth. And in Extra, when the full-grown man gets born out of that poor lady, he cuts his own umbilical cord.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, parallels. And they're both distributed by New Line Pictures.
Oh, good eye.
Yeah, pre-Freddy Krueger, so they're... doing all kinds of interesting stuff back then.
That's a cool connection.
And the poor lady who ends up giving birth in Extra, her dog is named Divine. And that is a reference to Pink Flamingos. The director said so.
Oh, that's awesome. Very cool. I like it. Continued connections. Loving it. Seems like you find one in every episode we've done. So I like it. Well, that... I guess we'll do it for this episode. Thank you, Stephanie, again for coming on and and doing good movie talk like you always do and putting up with my scattered nature.
Well, I'm scattered too. I'm glad we're trying to figure it out together.
But yeah, these are both really fun, interesting movies. I think we'd recommend you pick up both of them. But if you're only going to get one, definitely get Female Trouble.
Ooh, I agree with that.
All right. Well, everybody have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week. And I will talk to you all very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Roger begins with a horror film called Extro, that's X-T-R-O.
Remember that spelling? Remember that name? Our first movie is one of the most mean-spirited and ugly thrillers I've seen in a long time. It's called Extro, and it's a monster movie, and it's not a very good monster movie, but that's okay because most monster movies aren't very good. A lot of them, though, do somehow manage to be entertaining in a dumb, goofy, stupid sort of way just by giving us such ridiculous monsters. Mm-hmm. Extro doesn't even try.
Lots of